Pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Australian Senate, you're listening to news, views and opinions on events from here at home and around the globe on politics, business and society in general. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Thank you, Scott. Another marvellous introduction. We're back, folks. Episode 16 of the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove. And Scott, how are you feeling?
Oh, I'm really well, thanks, Trevor. And you?
I'm well. There's, you know, enough crazy religious people out there this week to fill up a podcast quite nicely. So that's taken the stress out of my week.
It certainly has. It was a rather interesting lot this week, but anyway.
Yep. So they never fail to deliver. So far, so good. So
absolutely.
So even in the absence of Tony Abbott, we can come through with a podcast.
Yeah, for sure.
So the first one, Scott, was we intentionally try and stay away from crazy American stuff, like, because they got their own problems, they're unique over there, and you know, if we were to do crazy American religious people, we'd just never stop. But one of those topics that was big over there was sort of bakeries, you know, doing wedding cakes and not wanting to provide wedding cakes for gay couples. And it seems that this argument has now crossed the Pacific, and the Australian version of the Anglican Church wants to import another crazy American idea.
Yeah, it was madness, wasn't it? I was reading about this. It's, there's a synod currently going on down there. Well, it's not currently going on because the report was the 30th of September, but there was an Anglican synod in the Archdiocese of Sydney, and in which case they were discussing this. Now, I was a little bit disturbed to read this because you usually think of the Anglicans as a reasonably moderate, sensible group of people.
Yep.
But when I read the Anglican Bishop of South Sydney, Robert Forsyth, he said he calls it justifiable discrimination. Some people accuse the church of raising the issue to stop same-sex marriage, he said. Well, why bring it up? You know, I mean, this is the thing. It's almost from one of the things I've seen about opponents of same-sex marriage is you bring something up, you complain about it, then you knock it down. You know, you don't actually just go ahead and say, well, you know, this is why, because you create an issue and you knock it down. You know, and that seemed to me what they're exactly trying to do there.
Yeah, well, anyway, he's produced a report arguing that wedding service providers should have the religious freedom to refuse to cater for gay couples. So he's you know, quite openly come out and said that. That's the Archbishop. I think he's been radicalised. So there's a lot of talk about radicalisation. Scott? It's possible.
Well, it is possible he has been radicalised, yes. That's a good point.
Yes.
He may well have been radicalised.
Yes. So, you know, we're talking about caterers, photographers, florists. He's saying he might object to providing their services to gay customers. And it's just another example of the appalling morality of these religious groups. I mean, why not just refuse to serve somebody because they're black, you know, and imagine you're in Alabama in the 50s and 60s. Like, it's the same thing. It's ugly.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm stunned by it, to be honest. I mean, it's really bizarre to read it here, considering it's come. You know, it's got our own, it's got an Australian accent to it too, which is what's really disturbing for me. I mean, this is the sort of nonsense you'd expect to hear with an American accent, not an Australian accent.
Yes,
so, you know, we seem to be stuck with it, unfortunately.
Yeah. I mean, the next thing you know, you'll go to the local shop, and you know, you won't be able to, you know, go through the cash register and buy your alcohol from Muhammad because he's against alcohol, and you know, you won't be able to, you know, buy your bacon from Joel because he's against, you know, pork products, and you know, you won't be able to buy your meat from Sally because she's a vegetarian. Like, if everybody just refuses because they don't like it, well, the world is going to grind to a halt.
Well,
in a very ugly way.
Yeah, and this is, and this thing, you know, this current sort of dressing it up as saying, well, this is our religious freedom. No, that's just nonsense. You know, I mean, at some point. Well, I mean, at the end of the day, I suppose the other thing is that the beauty of it all is that we can always say, well, you know, it's going to fall apart. So, you know, leave them all go belly up, I say. But anyway.
It's all going to fall apart, meaning the Anglican Church?
Well, not the Anglican Church, but the whole system that you've got it based on saying, well, we're only going to deal with heterosexual couples, not gay couples.
Yes.
So as a result, I mean, any of these businesses that do go that way, then, you know, I suppose that at the end of the day, if we know who the bigoted ones are, they can always just be put up and say, well, these are the people you don't deal with.
Yeah.
It's an option, but still in all, it was a madness one.
Yeah. I mean, the law actually provides that the clergy themselves don't have to act as celebrants, you know, in a gay marriage. And it's interesting. Current statistics are, I think, about 70% of marriages are conducted by civil celebrants. So people are voting with their feet in the marriage game.
And that's exactly right. I mean, like, you can see with it, people aren't bothering to get them solemnised by religious types in anyway. So the whole thing is just a load of nonsense. The whole thing is just a beat up about it all.
Yeah. Yep.
Anyway.
So I had on the agenda something about the Andrews government and same-sex adoption, but that's been covered already. I was basically drawing we look at some of the countries around the world and look at the nonsense they get up to, and we've actually got, you know, some similarities with them. Like in India, Mother Teresa's missionaries are now refusing to be involved in the adoption game because they're worried that single parents or divorcees will be able to adopt children. So they don't want to be involved. And you look at that and think, those, you know, crazy missionaries of charity. And yet, you know, we've got the same thing happening in Australia with religious groups wanting the ability to object to same-sex adoption, you know, in Victoria. So, you know, sometimes we think we're very civilised, but we've got some horrible, what would you say, similarities with some places that are still pretty crazy.
Well, we do. And, you know, I mean, Andrew's government, though, this is Daniel Andrews' government in Victoria, he's done really a wonderful thing. He's got I forget what the name of him is. Flynn is his name, and he is the equality minister. So what he's trying to do is he's got a for want of a better term, a program to remove all the discrimination in the laws. And one of those laws that they found is discriminatory was the laws over adoption.
Yeah, and they're willing to take up the fight. So good on them in the Andrews government down there.
Absolutely,
and
yeah.
You and Paul covered that while I was away. And I should have mentioned thank you to Paul for standing in my absence. And, you know, Paul's got such a lovely voice that if Paul just sat and read the phone book, I think I'd listen, because he's just got one of those voices. So I'd kill to have his sort of timbre and tone. But anyway, you're stuck with my nasally Australian drawl. But thank you, Paul.
Oh, dear. I'm sure he'll love that anyway.
Yeah. So Syria is worth a mention. I came across this interesting one. Well, in Russia, the weather report now, the Russian weather presenter, a forecaster, gives the weather forecast for Syria, proclaiming, "It's warm and sunny in Syria, and conditions are perfect for flying fighter jets and launching airstrikes."
I know. And, you know, it's really bizarre when it gets to that stage. And Here we go. You know, October in Syria is advantageous months for flights, the forecaster said. Noted the average wind speed is only 2.4 metres per second and rain typically falls once every 10 days. You know, it's just, it's odd that they have opened their, what's the word I'm groping for? Their state-run...
weather service.
Yes. Weather services, yeah, exactly. To have a lot of weather forecasting about Syria, which is a nation that they really have no... Well, they've got every right to be there, just like the rest of us are. But it's an interesting one. They've only flown 100 sorties over Syria, and they've only been at it for a week.
Yeah, so...
Which is surprising, the numbers that they've actually flown, so...
Well, when you build all those missiles, you feel compelled to use them, as the US government has found.
Well, I imagine so, but I mean, these are actual fighter jets that they've flown that are, you know, delivering ordnance the old-fashioned way around.
Right, okay. When you've made bombs, you want to drop them, yeah.
Well, precisely, yeah. You know, and anyway, interesting times ahead.
Yeah, sure. I mean, if you wrote a movie and had that in there, you know, about the weather forecast saying it's great conditions to be dropping bombs. People would say that's gone a bit too far. We'll scratch that out. But it's happening in real life. But, you know, on the topic of Syria, just briefly, I mean, Russia's entered the game and everybody's up at arms and going, well, you can't join our party. Like, we're all over here. And I'm quite flabbergasted by the righteousness of the other participants saying that it's terrible that Russia's going to be involved and that, you know, they're not taking all due care and attention and might well end up bombing the wrong people, etc., etc. Meanwhile, in Afghanistan, you know, the US has dropped a bomb on the Doctors Without Borders hospital, killing scores of people. They just are incapable of they can only see things in good guy, bad guy, and they're always the good guy, and Russia's always the bad guy, and they can't see beyond that.
Well, and that's what's really disturbing about this whole thing. I mean, because to my way of thinking, I think that the Russians have probably done this the right way, in that they've got the permission of Bashar al-Assad to be there. The other problem, though, is that it appears, from what we're reading anyway, is that the airstrikes have been taken out against targets that are opposed to Bashar al-Assad's government, including what's been determined by the Western forces to be moderate rebels.
Mm.
So I think that's probably America's main concerns, is that the wrong rebels are getting bombed.
Yes. So he's not actually attacking ISIS, but he's attacking the rebels who are attacking Assad. Mm. And what a mess. Again, we just keep saying, what a mess, and what are we doing there? And are we going to prop up the Assad government? Are we going to, you know, how do you win such a war? It's just not the place for us to be.
Well, I mean, I think that's exactly the whole point, is that it's not the place for us to be, and it's not. There's no way we can win a war over there with the conditions the way they are.
Mm.
I reckon we're better off out.
Yep. So, next topic, Scott, was Catholic marriages and annulments and the Pope. Like, I had a good old rant last week, I think, about the Pope being not such a great guy and why is everybody fawning over him. And what he's done in recent days... Yeah, he's active, this Pope. He's active. And what he's done is he's reduced a bit of red tape to make it easier for Catholics to remarry if they wish to, by virtue of granting annulments of their first marriage to free them up to get married again. So, for those who aren't aware of would you like to explain the Catholic Church annulment, or should I go ahead with that, Scott?
You go ahead with
okay,
that.
Okay, so...
You are the Catholic.
I am the Catholic. So,
yes.
So, So once you're married in the Catholic Church, they just don't believe in divorce. Like, you just can't divorce somebody. So what they have is this neat little trick to say that basically the way to get around it is that the marriage never actually happened in the first place, that the people weren't really married. And they declare that the marriage was null and void and never actually took place. Typically, deciding that at least one party lacked the correct intent to establish a lifelong commitment. And so then they can say, well, you were never married, and therefore, if you're looking to remarry, go right ahead and the Catholic Church will do that for you. And, of course, they used to charge quite a fee for that. And
there was a fee.
Definitely. And anyway, there was, you know, you had to go reasonably high up in the hierarchy to get an annulment, and there was a automatic review process. But the good old Pope has come out with a reduction in the red tape to make it easier to get an annulment, which sounds all fine and dandy, doesn't it?
Sounds good.
Yeah.
But.
But.
I'm learning there's always a but with this church. Yes, go on.
But these annulments are just a sham. Like, and to give you this great example, the most classic case, or the most notorious annulment, involved the marriage of Joseph Kennedy, who was President Kennedy's nephew and Robert Kennedy's son, who had married Sheila Rauch. So they had dated for 9 years before getting married in 1979. A year after they were married, she had twin sons. And then 11 years later, she filed for civil divorce, which he did not contest. So she got a divorce because she wasn't so keen on Catholicism, so she didn't care. She just wanted a divorce. Yeah. Anyway, a few years later, Joseph wanted to remarry, but of course he wanted to remarry in the Catholic Church. So he had to get an annulment. So,
and this annulment is the holy sort of divorce, is it?
That's right, which would allow him to say that the marriage never took place and that he was then free to marry again in a Catholic church. So basically he was arguing that he didn't know what he was doing when at the tender age of 27 he married the woman he'd been with for 9 years and the church granted him the annulment.
Oh, you're joking.
I mean, this is the sort of convoluted nonsense that religious people have to go through to sort of, you know, comply with their crazy rules. And, you know, his ex-wife was furious, and eventually there was quite a big hullabaloo about it, and the church eventually actually reversed the decision. But that's the sort of nonsense that you know happens with annulments. So it's, you know, it's going to be easier to get now that the Pope's reduced some red tape, but what you'll then have are these, you know, ridiculous situations of people who have been married for years and have children and the church declaring that the marriage never actually took place just so that, and what an insult to the other party is that?
Well, and that's the real point that I took from the article about Robert Kennedy's son and what was his name? Joe Kennedy, wasn't it? Joe and his former wife, Sheila Rauch.
Mm.
You know, seriously, it was as though she never existed, even though the fact that she'd had two, she'd borne him sons and all that sort of stuff. It was just madness.
Yes. So they were then classified as bastards, you know.
Exactly.
You know, conceived outside of marriage. Yeah. So, you know, on the face of it, he's reduced some red tape, but it's just more nonsense from the Catholic Church, and these are the sorts of things they do. I've got a bit of a, I'm trying to squeeze it into the You Cannot Be Kyrios file, which has been a bit bare lately, of sort of sports stars doing things. And I came across this one, Scott, which I've mentioned before, that for my sins, I subscribe to the Bible Society's newsletter.
And you must have a really interesting inbox, you know, if you're getting the stuff from the Bible Society in there, mate, let me tell you.
It's always good to know how the other side thinks. And,
well, I can understand that, yeah.
Came across this article. Ever heard of Jared Hayne, footballer?
I have, yes. I didn't realise he was all bound out with the Hillsong mob, though.
Yeah. So he's currently in America playing for the San Francisco 49ers and doing a pretty good job of transitioning. But back in 2015, he was at a Hillsong conference and he sent out a tweet to his followers. Jesus wanted to help people, but was killed by his own people. So a bit critical of the Jews there. And there was a bit of uproar about that. People pointed out, well, it was in fact the Romans who killed Jesus. And Hayne responded with, the Jews were the people who took him to the Romans and forced them to give the order because they couldn't. So having a bit of a go at Jews for killing the Jewish Jesus. Anyway, this article sort of then goes on to talk about, well, who really is responsible for killing Jesus?
Yeah, and it was go on. Sorry, I won't steal the thunder on this one, but it is hilarious what they come up with.
Well, it's quite a mathematical process, Scott, and I believe that you're at least 20% responsible.
Yeah, I mean, I was really surprised to hear that. Yeah. I mean, I wasn't even born when he was around, or allegedly around.
It's a fairly concrete number, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, but you come down to say that, you know, you as an individual are 20% responsible for it. I just thought to myself, well, how the bloody hell's that?
So let's run through them, because
very amusing, yeah.
This is this whole sort of theologian, fairyologist type thing that I continually gripe about, where these people claim to be doing scholarly work in this sort of field. And, you know, this article is a classic example, talking about the culpability of who killed Jesus. And so he goes through and he says, well, in fact, there's really sort of five categories of people here who are culpable in the death of Jesus. So number one, the Jewish people. So he agrees with Jared Hayne there and says, yep, you know, the Jewish people were responsible. Which is really odd, seeing Jesus was a Jew himself. So if there were no Jews, there'd be no Jesus. Like, but anyway, 20% to the Jews.
I mean, okay.
Then he says,
I'll give you my target at the end of it all.
Okay. Sorry. Then he says the Romans, well, they did the actual deed. So they're the second voice. So they're responsible as well, 20%.
Yep.
He said the third party guilty in the death of Jesus was Jesus himself. The argument being that...
Really?
Yes. Well, because he is God, that he could have stopped it at any point. So, so Jesus himself was responsible in some part towards his own death. Well, which is a valid argument.
It is a valid argument,
The fourth one is, he says, one of the worst to ponder, because it was God himself who was also responsible, because God, being God, could have stopped the death of his son Jesus. So he's another one who's up for it. And... He doesn't mention the Holy Ghost here. And, you know, I reckon, you've got the Father, Son, the Holy Ghost. Surely the Holy Ghost could also have stepped in and put a bit of smoke in the eyes of people and stopped that happening. But anyway, he doesn't mention the Holy Ghost. And finally, and this is where it comes down to you, Scott, because you're just as guilty.
I'm 20% responsible, yes.
So that finally, the most relevant to each of us is the responsibility each of us has had in the death of Jesus. Without our sin, and he's of course referring to our original sin, Jesus would not have needed to die. But he died for our sins, and otherwise we'd be eternally lost. And he goes on to say that... So when people mention that the Jewish people were culpable in the death of Jesus, they are 20% right, it's true. That's not the entire story. How grateful I am for the Lamb of God giving himself for our sins and demonstrating his own love to us in that one marvelous act. So yeah, there you go. That's the sort of scholarly, theological analysis of who's responsible for the death of Jesus, and you're in the dock, Scott.
I'm in the dock, hey? Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I suppose it had to happen eventually, didn't it? But, you know, this is the interesting thing about this, the whole story about Jesus and so on and so forth. I remember when I was at school, there was the whole, we're going through learning about this, the early stages of the apocalypse, of the end of Judaism in under the Nazis in the Third Reich.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of those things that had been brought up, they said, well, you know, the Jews, they had been blamed for killing Christ. And I thought to myself at the time, but hang on a minute. You were supposed to believe that Jesus had come to the earth to be sacrificed so that you could be forgiven your sins and so on and so forth. Therefore, surely it makes perfect sense to think, well, yes, you know, he had to die and so on and so forth so that I could go on and get be given my free pass out of hell. But anyway.
You're right. We should be thanking anybody responsible for the killing of Jesus because that led to our salvation, Scott, apparently.
Well, that's exactly it, you know. I mean, that is the whole point. Is that, you know, if you believe the nonsense that's in the New Testament, then yes, you should be eternally grateful for the execution of Jesus.
Hmm. So, you know, that 20% responsibility, instead of an indictment of your character, Scott, it should perhaps be seen as, you know, something positive to hang your hat on.
Well, that's what I think, too. You know, I think it should be seen as something positive, yeah, for sure.
20% responsible for saving the souls of the world, so...
Well, that's exactly it, yeah.
So that's some of the nonsense coming out of the Bible Society that we're supporting through our taxes, no doubt. Money well spent, Scott.
Well, particularly if they're going to give us material like this every week. Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Hey, do you remember Christina Keneally?
Keneally. She's an interesting one because, I mean, I thought, you know, she was not a bad Premier of New South Wales, I didn't think, at the time.
Mm.
And, yes, I'd always known that she was a Catholic and so on and so forth, but I had no idea just how far down she'd actually gone.
Mm.
You know, there's an article here from The Guardian, which I believe she's written. Yes, she has written it. Written it herself.
She
it
has.
Says, of course my faith influenced my political decisions, as did my gender. So what? Well, you know, it's... I'll be calm as I go through it now. But, you know, when I was reading it earlier today, I was getting really quite angry about it all. But as it goes through here, she said... religion isn't silly, of course, neither is politics most of the time. Occasionally the two intersect, but on the majority of matters I dealt with in state politics, she then goes to list off a whole lot of things that she did.
Mm-hmm.
My Catholic faith was of little help. Well, one would hope it would have absolutely no impact on you at all, I would have thought. But anyway.
I would have thought it would be a hindrance rather than a help, but... Go on.
Well, I mean, that's the other option too, is that, you know, it could be, you could see it as a hindrance rather than a help.
Mm.
Where was that other thing?
I'll tell you the bit that I really objected to. Can I tell you? Have you got it there? Or?
Well, I don't know. Were you getting down to the point, no sensible solution to some of the most vexed societal questions?
No, you can...
Okay, well, this one here, this is the part that really got me up. Really upset me somewhat. Is it, no sensible solution to some of the most vexed societal questions, whether on national security or marriage equality, can be derived or resolved without understanding and respecting the religious dimensions of human actions. What a load of nonsense, Fist.
Mm.
Honestly, this whole thing about that if you are religious, that everyone therefore must be, or if they're not religious, that's their new religion. You know, it's just a load of garbage, isn't it?
I think so. But
yeah,
the one that interesting because the paragraph that got me was she said.
There's another one here. Yeah, go on.
She said, "In fact, I've often wondered about atheist politicians."
Yes.
Surely, yeah. The logical conclusion to atheism is nihilism. In which case, why bother engaging in political activity? Trying to improve the lives of your fellow citizens and make the world a better place. Which politician is scarier? The one who insists there is ontological meaning and transcendental purpose to our lives, or the one who denies objective truth and believes that existence is ultimately a useless void? So she accuses atheists of nihilism. And that, dear listener, nihilism, that all values are baseless and nothing can be known or communicated. Believe in nothing, have no loyalties and no purpose other than perhaps an impulse to destroy. She doesn't understand atheists. And,
no, well, she doesn't. And, you know, this is one of the things that I found incredible about her nonsense too, is that honestly, with a lot of atheists that I've met, you know, they've... I think they actually find there's more to life.
Yes.
Because they believe this is it. You know, they believe this is it. They don't believe there's any afterlife or anything else. And so as a result, they're far more comfortable with the fact that they've got this one life and they've got to make the most of it.
Mm. Yeah, I was talking to a friend of mine about our podcast, and he's quite enjoying it. But he sort of made some comment about, oh, at least we've got religions. One thing they do is, you know, provide us with a bit of moral guidance and stuff, I guess. And of course,
that was a red rag to the bull. With
it
you.
Was. I turned on him and Mike. You know, you're aware of the moment, and said, you know, what do you mean? You know, you don't need religion to have a moral sort of code. Like there's no, and this is the fallacy that religions sort of thrust upon us and try and indoctrinate us with this belief that they are the ones providing the moral code. And you know, it's a complete nonsense that you need a religion. And again, if anything, it's a hindrance to a moral code being latched onto a religion. So, you know, it's Sermon on the Mount and Jesus and, you know, do unto others as you would have them do unto you type stuff. I mean, Confucius said that 500 years beforehand. I mean, any number of these sorts of things, you know, the good stuff in the Bible has most likely been plagiarized from stuff written 500 to 1,000 or longer years beforehand. And we've only just got to look at the current crop of religious followers around the world to recognize that they're not the font of all moral code, and if anything, the opposite. So,
no, I mean, that's exactly right. And when you do look at what's come out of the Royal Commission into the child sexual abuses, or the institutional responses to child sexual abuse, then in all honesty, they're not a moral code at all.
Yeah, but there you go. Somebody like Christina Keneally, who was Premier of New South Wales, basically thinking that unless you've got religion, then you're some sort of nihilist and incapable of a moral code and sort of untrustworthy. Like, this is from an intelligent, thoughtful woman. I just...
Yeah.
I should be surprised, but I'm not. So... we couldn't have a podcast at the moment, Scott, without some mention of the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Absolutely. Mm. Yeah.
So it seems like all of the parties have reached their secret agreement, and now it's up to the individual countries to pass the laws in their respective countries. And it's one of those things where you can't really amend it. It's like you take the deal as it is or not. And
yeah.
And I don't want to take the deal, Scott.
Well, yeah, and I understand why. I mean, certainly there's certainly an argument there that the Yanks have probably got it better out of everyone. You know, where is it? This is from the Drum website, driven by the United States. What measures were devoted to trade overwhelming were focused on exactly the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
Extending monopoly powers of American corporations and maintaining tariffs and quotas for US farmers unable to compete in a free trade world.
Yep.
Well, I mean, that's the whole point that does somewhat stick in my throat. You know, as far as these trade agreements go now, I mean, we've already opened ourselves up to a hell of a lot of international trade anyway. There's not a lot left
yep.
for us to actually give up on.
Yep.
And then on top of all that, we find out that what we are actually giving up on is Well, you know, we've signed ourselves up to ISDSs. We've signed ourselves up according to the free trade agreement with China, so that there's now potentially going to be, you know, Labor's already said they'll have to adjust the Migration Act and so on and so forth. It's really disturbing what our governments are giving away.
Yep. Yep. So this article that's linked on the website from The Drum kind of summarises a few things I've said in the past, which is that these major multinational corporations will use these investor-state dispute settlement clauses to stop us from passing legitimate laws, and business will say it wants the TPP because they're all about making profit and they don't care about the problems that it's going to cause in the country. So that's not their job. You know, the mere insertion of these sorts of clauses, you know, it'd be the big business lobbyists who have called for this. Like, they wouldn't have been dreamt up by bureaucrats. It's the big multinationals who want those clauses in there. And, you know, we mentioned before the classic case Australia's been involved in was the tobacco packaging. And what Andrew Robb has said is that tobacco packaging is expressly excluded in the sense that, you know, all the countries in the agreement can make laws in respect of tobacco packaging and they won't be sued. So he's saying, well, there you go. That's the one thing that Australia's been sued for, and I've made sure that it won't happen under this agreement. But, and he says, you know, we're party to many agreements and the sun still shines each day when we wake up. But the point is that we've never been in an agreement with the United States of America with an investor-state dispute resolution clause in it. And in case Andrew Robb didn't know it, like, the United States of America, they're the masters of litigation. Like, that's that's a core business of America, is suing people. So, sure, we might have had an agreement with Papua New Guinea, but, you know, they don't have a big pharmaceutical company that's going to sue us. So it's the nature of the people that we've been dealing with in the past are not litigant crazy Americans. And and this sort of field of endeavour in the law is a relatively new one, and it's one of those things that people hop on the bandwagon. Once they see an opening, they start exploring what other possibilities are available, and it becomes a growth industry. And I guarantee you that litigation under these ISDS clauses is considered a real growth market in the legal fraternity. And you've only got to look at poor old Canada, which has been party to agreements with the United States, which has had these sorts of clauses. And see what happens is it prevents a sovereign country from making laws stopping people from doing things, because the foreign company can say, well, that's an infringement of free trade. So, you know, in Canada, they want to stop fracking because of environmental reasons. And a foreign company that's either got fracking equipment or fracking rights says, well, you can't pass that law because that's an infringement of free trade. You're interfering with a foreign company's assets. So I've got a list here of some of the things that that Canada has been... Will you talk for a bit while I find this one, Scott?
Well, okay. Well, look, you know, the article the FIST is actually referring to is the conversation. Now, Canada has an ISDS clause with the United States out of their North American Free Trade Agreement. Now, in that, they've been sued 35 times. Now, out of that 35 times, the numbers are here. The total settlements have been $170 million Canadian dollars. There was a I think it was out of that 35 times they have been sued. There we go. The difference between Australia and Canada played out in total. Canada has faced 35 challenges, 23 of these in the last 10 years. Australia is subjected to only one ISDS case, and that, of course, is the ISDS case between us and Philip Morris over the plain packaging of cigarettes out of a an investor-state dispute settlement clause between us and Hong Kong.
So, Scott, I found the sort of things that that Canada's been sued for.
Yep.
Sorry, Scott, you go ahead.
What was this going to go on to was just we had here... Canadian companies have been rather unsuccessful in ISDS. In general, the claim that ISDS will primarily benefit the little guy isn't borne out by the statistics. And this is a concern for us because, like the FIST has said, you know, the United States is a more litigious society than we are. And the United States participants in that society, which is now their corporations, they tend to be a little more litigious than what we are. So... you know, I fear, and this is only a fear, but the fear I have is that Philip Morris is just, with their plain packaging, is that's a one of the issues we'll have to deal with a little more often now in the future as we go forward.
Yeah, well, I mentioned fracking was one of the things that was challenged. Then there was also a decision by a Canadian federal court to invalidate a pharmaceutical patent on the basis that it was not sufficiently innovative or useful. There was one about provisions to promote the rapid adoption of renewable energies. There was a law in relation to a moratorium on offshore wind projects in Lake Ontario. And a decision to block a controversial mega quarry in Nova Scotia. Like, these are all legitimate decisions by a sovereign government that it should be able to make. And, you know, both Canada and Australia, we've got legal systems second to none. Like, international companies can look at our country and go, well, things are conducted properly and civilized here. So we don't need to... agree to some, you know, international arbitration, because our system here is perfectly fine, and if you don't like it, don't do business with us. But the real risk in these clauses is it will stop us from making decisions about wind farms and quarries and pharmaceuticals and all sorts of things, not just tobacco packaging. And Andrew Robb has not, you know, banned all of those in his, you know, little exclusion clause. So they're too dangerous, and the analysis shows that our free trade agreement with America actually worsened our trade, international trade. So it doesn't even do what it says it will do. There's not even a plus side to this. So so having never seen it, but just based on the bits that have come out, I reckon it's one that we should say no to.
Well, I mean, and, you know, that's a quite a reasonable position to take, really.
Mm. There's one other issue on this too, was we have, it was in the, one of the ABC programs Monday, I think, about Foreign Investment Review Board decisions.
Yeah.
So in Australia, if you are a foreigner wanting to buy property, you basically can't buy existing properties unless you're an Australian citizen.
No, it's got to be brand new.
You've got to buy something that's going to be built or is in the process of being built. And the reason is that, you know, having foreign investors just pushes up prices, but at least if the foreign investors are buying new buildings, then that causes construction to be made and that benefits our community. So it's a very good law to have. Now, New Zealand doesn't have a law like that. And if they sign up to the TPP, they won't be able to introduce a law like that. Like, that sort of law would be an infringement of the TPP, and they wouldn't be able to pass it. So these very fundamental sovereign rights to pass laws about how you want to conduct your country are being thrown away with these agreements. And How dangerous is that?
Well, I mean, it is dangerous for sure. I mean, when you read the article there on the TPV prevents New Zealand regulating foreign buyers, it's really a hell of a concern.
Hmm.
And that's why I came back to the point I made a little while ago, you know, that we've already done as a nation a fair amount to liberalise our trade anyway.
Yes.
And then what we seem to be doing by signing up to the new agreements is to do away with stuff that really has very little to do with international trade. You know, it's really a concern anyway.
Hmm.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, I'm the first to admit, listeners, I do actually believe wholeheartedly in freedom of trade. We do have to have better trade so that as a species we tend to throw money at each other rather than explosives. But having said all that, it's pretty ugly.
Mm. I'm still halfway through it, but I'm reading a book by Naomi, and I can't remember her last name, but it's about the shock doctrine. And she's basically describing how in Latin America and other countries, when they entered into financial stress and the International Monetary Fund and various economists based out of the USA forced these countries to open up their borders to trade and also to sell off their public assets. And the multinationals came in and basically, you know, raped these countries. And really, it's depending on the state of the country, some countries need a bit of protection to get industries up and running. So yes, free trade's a good idea, but sometimes even a country like Australia might decide that there's a segment of the world economy that we want to promote, and in order to get it up and running, we might need a little bit of protectionism to just let that happen. So, I agree with you about free trade, but it's abused a lot, I think.
Well, certainly when you read more into the TPP and you hear about what the United States is getting out of it as opposed to what they're giving away,
yes,
then certainly there's a concern there that the thing does appear to be more one-sided than multi-sided, as it were.
Yep. So I came across an article about the problem with religious tolerance, and I really like this article, Scott. So it's a UK article. And while I don't normally read many articles, I'm going to read a bit of this one because his wording is superb. So, titled The Problem with Religious Tolerance by Alan Levinovitz in the UK. And basically, he was discussing a report that a British university of Warwick had banned Mariam Namazi, a secular human rights activist, from speaking on the campus. And the reason why Namazi was banned was because Namazi, an Iranian-born former Muslim, routinely challenges radical Islamic beliefs and criticizes many aspects of Islam. That was determined to violate the student union's policy, which forbids external speakers to spread hatred and intolerance in the community, and says they must seek to avoid insulting other faiths or groups. So, you know, Namazi's critical views could infringe upon the rights of Muslim students not to feel intimidated or discriminated against. So, he then, because it's, I mean, this is the UK, but the same applies equally in Australia. He said that when teaching introductory courses in religion, he finds students unwilling to offer critical appraisals of religious beliefs for the same reason. They think that refraining from criticism is essential to religious tolerance. So, you know, after all, if you claim that a religious belief is wrong, aren't you being intolerant? Better to accept religious relativism than run the risk of bigotry. So does that sound familiar? I mean, I reckon that that's going on all the time in Australia.
Absolutely. It's going on all the time, and it's really got to stop. Yeah. It's absolutely mad.
So, you know, we're running against the grain here on the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove, where we're pretty harshly criticising religion. But, you know, we're not bigots, and we're not intolerant. Like, in case people don't understand, my position, and you can say whether you agree with this, Scott, is if somebody wants to practice a religion as an adult, go for it. Go right ahead. Provide it's got nothing to do with me. You can do whatever you like in private, and really, to a large extent, in public, provide it's not, you know, infringing certain rights. But basically, people, go ahead. If you want to believe in this crazy nonsense, do it. My objection is where you take that belief and you restrict what I want to do, or where you then want to take that belief and indoctrinate your children and essentially hypnotise them before they're ready. That's where that's where we're, or at least I'm against them. I don't know. Do you want to state your view at this stage, Scott?
Oh, look, that, and I agree with that wholeheartedly. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, you know, for me, you know, I'm quite happy to say it. I have an open mind about those larger questions of life. There might be something beyond the crematorium. There might not be. I don't know.
Yeah.
However, what I do know for certain is that the stuff that's printed in the books is nonsense. And I get really upset when you have people that say, we've got to legislate this way because this is God's will. Mm. You know, that's what really annoys me.
Yeah. So, you know, there's this notion that basically all views are equally valid and truth is relative to the individual. You know, you can't criticize a religion because there are no rights or wrongs in religion. And I just say that there are rights and wrongs, and some of the teachings are appalling and should be stopped. So, and that doesn't make me a bigot, and it doesn't make me intolerant. I mean, intolerant would be if I was, you know, jumping up and down and having a temper tantrum or throwing punches or whatever. But I'm, you know, merely saying that you're wrong, some of you people, with some of your beliefs. And in the community and amongst the progressive sort of sections of the community, it's this feeling that you can't criticise religion. There's multiple religious perspectives, of which they're all equally valid and deserving of respect, is the sort of thing that you would hear on Q&A, Scott.
Yeah, but, you know, yeah, anyway.
Yep.
I find that really bizarre to say that a particular religious tenet is deserving of respect. I mean, some of them, it's just not.
Yep. So there's a great line here where he says, the result is disastrous. Suddenly we're in the land of bumper sticker postmodernism, where truths are perspectival and no one can be objectively wrong.
Wrong.
And he's saying that's dangerous, disrespectful and untrue. It's dangerous because it means people will be less likely to fight against injustices and falsehoods that are underwritten by religion. How true is that? He says it's disrespectful because authentic respect involves caring when others' beliefs go wrong, not just letting them believe what they want, which is true. And it's untrue because basic logic tells us that, you know, God condones slavery, God forbids slavery. They can't be equally valid claims, and some religions hold those opposing views. So they can't all be true, depending on your point of view. And, you know, he sort of likens it to a middle school art show where people ooh and ah and praise the work without passing judgment on its quality, lest they hurt someone's feelings. I like that one. So that was a great article, I thought, on the UK situation. Incidentally, that university reversed its decision and allowed that person to speak. But the fact they made that decision in the beginning is a bit of a worry.
Yeah, but even with all that, like, that's, I mean, I know it's a different person, but I own Ursie Alley, who's not a fundamentalist idiot by any stretch of the imagination. She's been banned from speaking on campus too.
Mm.
you know, it's absolutely madness what's happening.
Yep, yep. And finally, Scott, we spoke last week about radicalisation of young Muslims and what can be done to prevent it. And I was listening to the Religion and Ethics Report, and Andrew West had an interview with a lady, and her name is Professor Samina Yasmin from the Center for Muslim States and Societies. And I've got a little clip here to play, Scott, and I'll play that and then we'll talk about it. So,
and one thing that we have come across is this sense of not belonging. And I think it comes partly from the spaces in which they grow up, because they only interact with other Muslims who have similar ideas, but it also grows out of the media coverage. So part of the problem comes from the space in which they find themselves in. But there's another problem, which is that they are exposed to information about Islam and being a Muslim, which is very globalized information. So you tell a young man who actually doesn't know about Islam, his parents may be very busy earning their living, family is still struggling from the impact of migration, and at the same time dealing with this wider concern about Muslim community in Australia. And someone comes to them and says, you know, brother, you're being targeted because you're a Muslim and because there is a caliphate, and why don't you do something to support that caliphate? Why don't you do something for the Muslim Ummah? They're really being sold an idea of Islam, which is not really Islamic. But these young people have very little information pool to actually look at that information critically and see whether it's true or not. And so they're more likely to be taken in by that.
What do you reckon, Scott?
Well, you know, yeah, it's a bizarre one, because, I mean, if listening to that response there, I think to myself, no, we've got a ridiculous situation where they're saying that it's everyone else's fault except the Muslims. The other point that I would make out of that too is that the argument that it's I can't remember exactly what she said, but she said, you know, these are the people who don't feel like they belong, you know, that somehow it's everyone else's fault except theirs.
I actually a bit more positive about what she said than you are, but I reckon she's quite right about a couple of things. One is she talks about their interaction being largely with other Muslims, and I reckon that's true, that they're in a bit of a bubble where they're not, you know, integrating and assimilating with the wider Australian community. So I think that is a big thing. And then she talked about their education about Islam, she was saying, is really quite poor, that they didn't really know much about their own religion. So anyway, Scott, the good news is that if we adopt secular party policies, then we can go a long way to addressing the things that she was talking about, because, you know, we want public schools well-funded and full of kids from all walks of life participating without wearing any religious paraphernalia and receiving no indoctrination, but instead a wide religious education about all faiths, including their own. So, you know, it just makes sense to me that if we start with kids where everybody goes to public schools and all these barriers that religion builds up are wiped away when you walk through the school gate, and when you're in school you'll be taught about the other faiths and about your own faith. I reckon at the end of that, that sounds to me like a de-radicalisation program, Scott.
Well, it is, because you're going to have people of all different backgrounds in the same school. Mm. And, you know, it's I'm pretty sure I've mentioned it before, but Lee Kuan Yew, Prime Minister in Singapore, you know, that's exactly what he did. He made sure that the schools were not just for Muslims, weren't just for Chinese, weren't just for Malays, that they were for everyone.
Mm. Yep.
You know, so, yeah, I wholeheartedly agree with you.
Yeah. So, anyway, Scott, I reckon that we're up to our 60-minute time limit now, so...
I reckon we probably are.
Yeah,
too,
yeah. So folks, we shall call it a night on that one there, and we'll be scouring the podcast, the newspapers, the magazines, the online articles, and discovering all the secular issues for you that occur during the week, and we'll be back next week.
Absolutely. Well, all the best, and thanks very much for listening
in. Okay, everyone. Bye. Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time, and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast, and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf, on their phone, and just put the word out. The other thing is you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon, and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really, the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation. So you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners. And that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.